Okay, today is... What the heck is today? June 27th, we'll say?
Let's check and be sure.
You know, I always...
Yes, it is.
All right.
Yes.
So, this is the third interview with Joel Solomons. Again, we're here in his office inside the University Club. My name is Troy Reeves. I'm with the UW Mass and Oral History Program. Joe, since I've kept my streak of having three different recorders, could you start off by saying your name and spelling your last name so I can check the sound quality?
My name is Joe Solomons, and that's spelled S-A-L-M-O-N-S.
Great, thank you. It's picking you up just fine, actually. It'll be a little on the heavy side, so we're going to turn it down a touch.
But of course, I'll change my volume level
right.
So consistently that whatever you get is going to be suboptimal.
You'll change the volume level, you'll shift in your seat, and
it'll
all be thrown off anyway. Joe, I want to start not with the 2011 protests, not with the 2010 election. I actually want to start with the 2008 election. And just a general question about how you would describe, if you even would describe, your involvement in that election.
Well, I mean, I'm involved in every election in terms of voting and working for candidates at the state and local and national levels.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was, did you mean nationally in particular? Or?
I mean, particularly in this case, the national.
Wow, that's kind of a hard and complicated question. I did some volunteer work for Obama. I was a little slow in making up my mind which way to go in the primaries, but politically, I have a permanently uncomfortable relationship with the Democratic Party, which is where I usually end up investing my energy, there's this point at which you decide, okay, well, I know this is going to go off the rails, but it is better than the alternative, and that often ends up making me do something. And I spent some hours of volunteer time knocking on doors and stuff like that.
Okay.
At the national level.
Okay. And the reason why I ask that question is, I wonder if you've thought about it, or even if you haven't, if the results, particularly nationally, 2008, had any correlation to then what happened here in Wisconsin on the state level in 2010.
Well, I mean, you know, you should ask a political scientist about that, but I mean, my intuition is that, sure, there's some backlash, but you know, things, and I mean, speaking as a white Southerner, I've watched my whole life the half disguised politics of race, and a lot of what happened after 2008 from the right was just smells of that to me. But at the same time, I mean, it's very clear that what happened in 2010 and since in Wisconsin and in other states across the country were parts of programs and agendas that had been going on for a very long time. I mean, it was very interesting to see the discussions of the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, come up. You know, there was a point at which if you had said, well, there's this right-wing group writing all this anti-union legislation, writing all this anti-public education legislation, et cetera, you would have sounded like a fringe conspiracy theorist. But, you know, when you start looking at what happens and you start listening to the similarities that are coming out, it's, I mean, you know, clearly there's a program, and it's not, I mean, you don't have to, it's not a conspiracy theory. I mean, everybody is working to get their political program advanced, and I think that's what that's what happened. So there's a there's a piece of it that's connected to the national scene. I mean, I think if instead of Barack Obama, a person with the exact same political strategies and beliefs and background had come in, and his name had been Troy Reeves, and he'd been a white guy from Idaho, things would have been somewhat different. They wouldn't have been completely different. I mean, Bill Clinton didn't have, there was a reaction to Bill Clinton, but sure, I think there were things about Obama that changed, and not just, I mean, I mentioned race because I really think it was a piece of the puzzle, but there are other, you know, that's just one dimension of it. But at the same time, there's a longer term trajectory. I mean, I think that a lot of things go back to 1980. I think when you start having the successful political discussion about government is a terrible thing. And I mean, I say that as somebody who's not always in favor of government and government solutions, but that's clearly what the nature of the discussion has been since 1980, whether you like it or not. And the places where that has come to bear on, in particular, higher education are very clear. I mean, I think if you look at the, if you track the tuition rates, you track, I mean, one of the first things, you know, I went to undergraduate school on Social Security survivor benefits, and my father passed away when I was 15, and I was able to work some fast food jobs and get through undergraduate school without having to take loans, basically, because of that. One of the first things that Reagan did in 1980 was eliminate Social Security survivor benefits for college. It's that sort of drip, drip, drip thing of here's another door, here's another way that people, and it goes back to the discussion we had last time about, or it's discussion, the weird thing about this is that it's not a discussion. But it goes back to the point last time about access and affordability. And every time you close one of those doors, it's, I mean, there's some kids that are going to take advantage or have the opportunity to take advantage of one program or another program, and it's having that full range of opportunities to get people into the university or into a higher education in some meaningful way. And I think that's where we started to see things slip. And it's simplistic 30-second history of an incredibly complicated, fraught thing, but I think that's...
Well, thank you for that, Joe. So as a now Wisconsinite working on campus, how did you react or feel in November of 2010 after the governorship and the legislature all became controlled by Republicans?
Well, I think we sort of knew, I won't say that I knew that was coming, but it was pretty clear if you were politically engaged what was happening and what the likely outcome of the election was going to be, and again at all sorts of different levels, what impact it was going to have in terms of the House and the Senate nationally, and in terms of state government. I'm not sure I appreciated at the point at that time how stark things were going to be, how dramatic some of the changes were going to be, and I think a lot of people were in that same boat. Do you remember the Onion headline after Bush got elected? This might have been the first week after the election was actually decided. Bush: our long national nightmare of peace and prosperity is over. And a whole lot of people, I think, really thought, oh no, he's not really going to do that much. But, you know, you look at that, you know, 12, 13 years down the line, and it's like, whoa, there was really a, you know, there was a dramatic change in our peace and prosperity starting with that election. And I think there's a little bit of that, you know, if the Onion was still a local thing, Walker, our long national state nightmare of peace and prosperity is over. I think I didn't appreciate how dramatic the changes were going to be.
So my guess is, and please sort of disabuse me of this notion, things were sort of status quo normal-ish, even during the first few days and weeks of the Walker administration and the new legislature.
Yeah, and of course, if for a group like Profs, we were very concerned about what was going to happen, and you try not to make a lot of assumptions about what's going to happen, and you start trying to talk to people, looking for things that you can do, and that sort of LBJ politics is the art of the doable. You know, what can we do here that's going to help the university or spare the university from difficulties. But part of that, Profs had started before I became president. Profs had started to have occasional forums, brown bags, to get the faculty more aware of what the real issues were and what the mechanics were of what's euphemistically, or not what's regularly called the other end of State Street. So I think there's less apathy among the faculty than people, even there was less apathy in say 2010 than people often talked about. But there's a difference. It's one thing to be concerned about something, to have you know, worries or hopes or whatever, and to have a sense of, oh, okay, here's the question I need to ask. Here's the thing that I need to be thinking about. Here's where it's going to matter what happens. And Profs had been, starting with Louise Robbins when she was president, I think was when those first started, was having some brown bags with people from politics, people from campus, people from BASCM, so university administrators, just to sort of give people an idea of how the political process works. Because, you know, even if you're a citizen and you vote, participate in sort of the normal ways, that doesn't mean you really understand what the budget process is like, and, you know, where the sausage gets made, and who gets to toss in what spices. And we had some of those, and I think it was clear to us with the elections, before the elections and especially after the elections, that this was going to be an important thing, that we needed to make sure that the faculty and the broader university community, staff, classified and academic staff, students, graduate and undergraduate, were thinking about what our situation was and where they, if they were so inclined, could do something.
So I'm going to ask about the Pocan story, but was that a Profs meeting? Is that?
Yeah, that was. It was called State Budget 101, and it was the Friday before Valentine's Day. So Monday was the 14th, so that would have been the 11th. Yeah. So we had set it in the Wisconsin Idea Room. So the education building had just been remodeled, and we were Michelle Felber from Profs had said, "Oh, we should get the Wisconsin Idea Room. The new education building is just beautiful, and it is. And what better place than the Wisconsin Idea Room to have this forum?" We had, I think it's on the Joni Juster tape, so you can check the, and it's written up, it's around generally on the Profs website and stuff, but it was Mark Pocan, Pete Christensen, a lobbyist who's been involved with the Alumni Association, and Don Nelson, who's a university lobbyist. And it was exactly what I just described. Here's how the state budget's going to work. Here's what's going to happen. Here's how it's going to go down. And it was, there's a sense in which it sounds like, you know, freshman poli-sci class lecture. But, you know, you've got three guys here who have been involved in the process, different perspectives, different positions, and having them talk about what it's like going through the process is pretty different from reading it in the state journal or something. So they're talking through here's the timing, here's when this will happen, and here's what actually happens in the budget committee, here's what happens when it goes when it goes to the governor's desk. And so fairly routine, and there was a lot of, you know, people knew that it was not going to be a good budget year for us. And so the room was pretty full. There must have been, I don't know what that room holds, but there must have been 60, 70 of us in there. And TAA people, academic staff people, classified staff, so not just faculty by any means. And I was sitting taking notes furiously. It was just really interesting, and I was learning a ton. And I mean, I was sitting basically sort of off to the side, in the corner, the northeast corner of that room. So I was sort of parallel to the three panelists, and I could see the whole room. And people were intent. They were very attentive. They were watching. They were taking notes. It was not something where people were reading the newspapers. I mean, it was serious. And the real story is, as I told you earlier, at a certain point during the thing, Pocan had his. Had left his BlackBerry out on the table, and he was looking at it. And we're a little further down the road now, and so the culture has settled out a little bit in how we deal with smartphones and things, and when it's appropriate to look and not look. And he started looking to an extent and so overtly that, you know, it was, I think everybody in the room was noticing it. There's an old story about Clarence Darrow that he used to, when the other side was presenting arguments, he would he always smoked cigars in court, and that he would take a paperclip and straighten it out and run it through the cigar. And when the other side was presenting closing arguments, he would smoke the cigar, and the ash would hang on the straightened paperclip, and eventually the jury would start paying attention to what the hell's going on with this guy's cigar. He's got a 4-inch ash on the end of it, and stop paying attention. It was getting to be a little bit like that, where everybody was pretty well noticing it. And he said at a certain point, folks, I mean, you see, obviously I'm paying attention to my BlackBerry. It's not because I'm being rude or I'm not interested in what's happening here. On the contrary, but news is starting to leak out that the Walker budget is going to come out on Monday, and it's going to be very hard. It's going to be worse than we expected, it's just messages from my staff and colleagues, and I'm just keeping an eye on it. I'll tell you more as it comes. So from that point forward, we were listening to what was happening, but every eye in the room was focused on Pocan's BlackBerry sitting on the panelist's desk. And some more pieces came out. He said he said at some point, something about collective bargaining. So we sort of knew, we didn't have any idea that it was going to be what became Act 10, but we knew that something was afoot. And that was, you know, Friday afternoon, so we had the weekend of things, emails floating and a lot of speculation, but basically holding pattern. That Monday, Valentine's Day, the TAA had had organized their Valentine's for UW campaign, and they took huge numbers of Valentine's down and dumped them in the Capitol, delivered them to the Capitol. So that was the that was coincidental timing, but it was just it was really interesting timing. So from the point of view of the say the TAA organizers and leaders who were in the room at that forum, I think there was a sense from talking to some of them and other people afterwards, okay, this is we're now in it. You know, it's no longer getting ready. This is coming. This is starting now. And a pretty clear indication that it was going to be a battle.
Did you, and a lot of this is going to be somewhat similar ground to what Joni talked about.
And that was, my memory was very fresh then, right. So right. There are discrepancies, trust what she got.
So did you attend, I guess, A, did you know that the Valentine's Day event was going to happen?
Yeah, I filled out a Valentine, but I was unable to go. I think it conflicted with my teaching. And I'd been in touch. I knew about it. TA people, CAPE, other groups were participating. I think at that point, the sense was, okay, this is a bigger deal than, you know, it happens. The timing makes it a bigger deal than we originally thought. It was just going to be this sort of TA gesture for support for UW.
So when was the first time that you went to the Capitol, at least from your memory of it?
That was, I guess it all started going crazy Monday afternoon. Was that when it really broke? And then the first time I went was Tuesday morning.
Okay.
And it was pretty busy then. It was a lot happening.
Do you have initial memories of what it looked like, what you thought when you first got into the building?
Yeah, it was, there were a lot of people there. It seemed like at the time, that was before the building was so packed that you literally had trouble walking from almost anywhere in the building. But I mean, it was full, and you know, I've been, especially with profs, I've been in that building a lot of times, and it's, you know, the school groups going through, and there's the usual traffic, a few tourists. I'd never seen anything like it. I'd been there for ceremonies that were fair sized, or when ceremonies were taking place, and you know, you could see a good number of people there. I'd never seen quite that many people. And the other thing that still really stands out is that it was Wisconsin. You know, there was this thing of, well, is it just going to be university people? Is it just going to be a couple of unions that have turned out all their people? But I have the privilege of knowing people from a whole lot of different walks of life in Dane County, and there were people of every group that I know, retired union workers, public employees, graduate students, teachers from the community, just the whole, everybody. It was a pretty good cross section of the community there. And that was pretty striking. So,
did you try to participate in the hearings regarding the bill?
Yeah, I didn't actually speak, but I attended the hearings, and mostly went to support. So a lot of the people speaking were graduate students, the people that I knew, graduate students, and staff people, and I went mostly to support them. There were faculty voices there, but we weren't the ones who were most immediately affected. I mean, it's a case where I still think that the logical thing for faculty to do was to support the people they work with who were going to be directly affected by this, who were going to lose collective bargaining, who were going to lose. I mean, you know, I took a 10.5% pay cut with the changes to the contributions that took place. But for me, that's an inconvenience for a lot of the people who were signing up to testify. It was a real difference maker. I mean, people, you know, our graduate students, TAs, project assistants, and so on, and classified staff, and even academic staff. A lot of them were already in situations because of the low pay raises over the years, because the University of Wisconsin's not been particularly high paying as an institution. A lot of those people were already in situations where having an apartment and food and healthcare was difficult. To make things worse for them was a bad deal in my view.
And just throwing out some general questions here. So, from what you remember, let's put it this way: how did you balance teaching? You said you taught a class that semester, maybe more than one, and what was going on at the Capitol?
Oh, that was balance? Did you say balance? So it was a class that in my sort of main area of expertise, historical linguistics, but it was a class I happened not to have taught that particular class in that particular text. I'd never taught that textbook, but I hadn't taught that particular class in a long time. So that's a fairly, and I don't know, 25 students or something, so a good sized class. And had a set of graduate students I was working with, and I meet with them for an hour a week, and you know, various research projects. So it was a heavy semester. It was a busy semester, basically I decided that there was nothing to do except to keep up on all fronts, and so I was spending as much time as I possibly could for those first days and weeks at the Capitol, there were times. I mean, you know, I went up there sometimes and would run into my graduate students and my undergraduate students who would be sitting there in the Capitol, just sitting on the floor, you know, second floor of some hallway, and I'd look and they were reading, and they were reading the assignment for the next day's class. Walk by a dissertator and he says, oh, by the way, I'm going to have chapter 2 for you tomorrow. There was no balance. I mean, everything was, you know, in the pie chart of what were you doing with your time, it was 100% work and 100% dealing with this, and almost no time sleeping. But it was like that for a lot of people, and it was like that for people in ways that they were sort of combining things. Or, you know, if any downtime at the Capitol, you know, go to the TAA office, and people were working like mad. It was so impressive to see how this graduate student union, people who again had their obligations as teaching assistants, project assistants, research assistants, were meeting those. And I know a whole bunch of them, and I know their jobs, and that they were meeting their doing more than they were required to do for their jobs, but also were running this incredibly efficient, effective operation, organizing things in a way that sort of beyond what you really had to do. I mean, there were lots of discussions about making sure that everything was orderly, that there was that people were taking care not to do anything that could you know, be seen as damaging the building or being, you know, out of line in any way. So there was, I mean, I would not have, when I was a graduate student, I would not have had the good sense to have that sense of propriety about doing things. But they did, and they organized it, and there were people there. But at the same time, you would see, you know, there, you know, there'd be a couple of people off in the corner, you know, preparing their discussion session for their the class that they were TAing for the next day. So people were burning the candle at both ends for sure.
So the 14, the Wisconsin 14, left. And then there was a brief, since it feels brief now, but there was a period there of, and detente probably isn't the right word, but...
No, that's not the right word.
Thinking that nothing was going to happen until they came back.
Yeah.
But then something happened.
Yeah.
So I wonder if you can, I know again, this is a story that you told to Joni, but if you could talk about that night.
I didn't particularly think that anything was gonna happen. Everybody at that point, of course, everybody was always on edge. It was like at any moment. And I had here's something that feels different a couple of years down the line. I had a cell phone that had text capability, but it was the kind of cell phone that by the time this is in, anybody besides us listens to this will be forgotten by all but the oldest human beings alive. The cell phone that in order to text you had to use the keypad and touch the right number of times to get to the letter in order. So sending a 5-word text could be a 3-minute ordeal, but I can receive text. So communication was still heavily by email, Facebook, cell phone calling, things like that. I was sitting at this desk, had a late meeting with a graduate student, finished up, it must have been 5 o'clock or something, was getting ready to go home. And I was literally closing that laptop, that same laptop that you see sitting there. I was about to close it, and the email refreshed, and an email came from the TAA, and another one from somebody I knew, don't remember, I could guess, but I won't, about basically the same thing, saying, get to the Capitol right now. If there's any possible way, get to the Capitol right now. And I thought, well, I don't know. I mean, surely there's nothing big going on. I need to pick up something for dinner. I'll just go up to the square and I can grab something little there. And I'll check in and see, and there won't be anything going on, and I'll just go home. So I went up. Very few people. You know, of course, there were people who had been there all the time. I went in, and it was pretty clear what was going to happen. That is, that it was going to be forced through. The bill was going to be forced through, and it was a small group. A lot of them, people who had been there, had been spending a whole lot of time there. And so I couldn't really text people, but I made a few phone calls as sort of the kind of last gasp of the old phone tree approach to things, and said, it looks like there's something going on here. You know, if you can make it down. And the TAA, as throughout the whole thing, the TAA was ahead of everybody. There were more TAs present from the beginning than anybody else, including, I think, a lot of other unions. We were, of course, we couldn't go into the room where the meeting was. People were standing outside. Chanting, people had signs and so forth, and I stood, I saw people I knew, I talked to people, asked what was going on. Basically, nobody knew much of anything at that point. And I waited. And probably an hour and a half or something afterwards, I was going to go and check and see if some people that I'd called had made it in. And it had been, I don't know, 60 or 70 people, something. So not a huge crowd, but, you know, kind of narrow spaces that you have in the Capitol. And I was vaguely aware that the numbers had been increasing, but I turned to leave, and there was no way. It was jammed, completely jammed. I mean, I had sort of felt like, well, my personal space was getting smaller and smaller, but now it was like almost impossible to get out. And I got out. And that was when they had started controlling access to the Capitol. And so I had with me then, as I always do, this Gerber pocket knife. My brother-in-law gave it to me. Wonderful, like the best small knife I've ever had, including the Barlow my father bought me when I was a little kid that I still have and use. And of course, you can't get that through the inspection, and so I signed a piece of tape and put it on it and handed the knife over so I could go in. And I figured that just the controls on the doors would mean that the crowd wouldn't grow that fast. And so the crowd's there, it's big, we don't know what's going to happen. Getting noisier. I try to get out, and it really takes a long time before I can get to anywhere where there's like open space. And so I call a couple of people, had a couple of text messages, and people were coming or were trying to get in. And at some point in there is when the crowd just overwhelmed, and people just started flooding in, and the you know, that security system basically broke down for the evening. And then it just became, for the moment, I mean, things were, and the whole place was just jammed at that point, like it was in those early days where it was just so full that you wondered, you know, is this architecturally safe? Mm-hmm. People were pretty noisy, and getting increasingly noisier. The announcements came through, clear the building, you're in the building illegally. And I started asking people, really, is that true? No, ignore it. Not partisan people, but, you know, like the sort of most neutral people that I could find said, no, it's something's wrong there, that can't possibly be right. And of course, the place was just people were flooding in. And in that sort of second big wave after the doors opened up, a whole bunch of faculty that I knew, some very political, some very involved in university politics, and some just rank and file faculty were showing up. And everybody, of course, it was just complete grapevine. What do we know? What's happening? Just crazy, completely crazy. And people chanting, especially shame, was a big chant that night for obvious reasons. And word comes down that they've passed the bill. It's not clear to me, and I think to a lot of other people, whether that was a proper vote at that point. People were, it was a pretty unsettled thing. I mean, despite the stuff that, you know, people tried to gin up this thing later of all the protesters did damage, all the protesters were so disrespectful, it was remarkable for the sort of good, positive, constructive atmosphere of things. I mean, of course, there were people around who you know, every now and again you'd see some comparison of Walker to Hitler or something. But I mean, really, people were there for a purpose, and they knew the purpose, and they were acting toward that, to get to that goal. But that night, I think there was I think a lot of people had a sense of dirty pool, that people were going to do anything they can to ram this through. And after the news came down that they had passed it, there was Mark Pocan and some other members of the legislature and staffers started saying, well, you know, this is, we don't think this went down the right way, we don't think this is appropriate, and we'd like to have people sign saying that they witnessed what happened here. And so there was a shuffle for a half hour of getting people to sign these affidavits, basically. So that took a while, and it was, they were really struggling to Xerox things, get things out to people. People were signing, even trying to get pens together. And it was things like, you know, Pocan standing on a chair and trying to explain to as many people who could crowd into here him as could under the circumstances, what was going on. And by 10:30 or 11, surely that had sort of taken care of itself, and there was a sense that there wasn't much more to be done that night.
Did you, I think it's been a while, and events like this have a tendency to, everything sort of conflates a little bit.
Yeah.
Did you attend any of the Saturday or the weekend protests? And if so,
oh yeah, of course, yeah.
Were there, are there events that happened there or specific Saturday protests that stand out in your mind?
Well, yeah, I mean, in some ways, this is one where things don't run together maybe as much as they do in other cases. I remember plays from UW football games, but I can't tell you what game and what day, but this is a little different. One of the ones that really stood out was the weekend that there was a Tea Party rally, and I went up, that was a Saturday, I went up to the TAA office, and they said they needed volunteers, and what they were doing was they were getting people to basically help monitor. And this is a really clear indication of where the TAA and other people's minds and hearts were at during this. What they did was they gave a set of us orange pennies, orange vests, and asked us to go. They knew where the Tea Party demonstration was going to be, and that people were going to be walking the square, and asked us just to go and make sure that there was no conflict, that there was nothing that was going to lead to violence or other inappropriate activity. And I remember thinking, I don't know, like, I'm not really the guy for this job exactly. Crowd control, that's not me. But a bunch of us did it, and it was very interesting. And again, hearing some of the rhetoric afterwards about, oh, the protesters had no respect for the Capitol and for the political process. No, I was there doing that job during that whole event. I was walking. It was basically a line between the two parties, and there was nothing that could be construed as untoward behavior from the protesters. There were a few times where there were groups of people on the two sides were engaged in intense conversations, but it was intense conversations about deeply held views. But every single piece of insulting and name calling basically was from the Tea Party people, and there was very little of that, I have to say. In other words, people, this was not some sort of thing that was going to instantly break down into a riot. It was a sign of the TAA's seriousness about what they were doing, that they had us doing that job. But I think even if we hadn't been there, and it was not going to be any trouble. These were people practicing democracy in the kind of messy way democracy gets practiced when people care about what's happening. So that was a remarkable day.
Mm-hmm. Were you there the day the tractors came on the square?
Yeah.
I don't think that was the same day.
No. There was, so the tractors were there a couple of times. There was the day where, like, even the conservative estimates had 100,000 or close to 100,000 on the square. And that was the day I was not there. I'd been invited to be a speaker at a student conference at Indiana University in Bloomington. And of course, you accept those things, and it's a really good program. It got a lot of good students in linguistics and in Germanic languages. And so I accepted long before I knew that any of this was going to happen. And so it turns out this is going to be a particularly big protest weekend. And so I was sitting there in the back of the room. My talk was, the plenary was late afternoon, and I was sitting in the back of the room just watching the news feed from Madison, just seeing the bigger and bigger and bigger numbers showing up. So that was the one big one that I missed.
Mm-hmm. That leads me to at least one more question, which is the role of the media in the protests.
Yeah, another complicated question. It's an interesting thing, and people like you are much better positioned to talk about it than me. But it was a breakpoint in some ways, I think, in how I thought about the media. So I had always subscribed to the Wisconsin State Journal. It's the local paper. It's the city paper. And even after the Cap Times stopped doing a print edition, I kept getting the State Journal because it's how you stay on top of things. Well, they had endorsed Walker and supported Walker. And so at a certain point, I stopped getting the State Journal. I just couldn't stand it. And their coverage was their coverage was not good. And it's that thing you see every time you are directly involved in something, have direct knowledge of it. They talk about stuff that you really, really know. The State Journal's coverage of that event was just pretty pitiful in terms of the substance of what was happening politically, and in terms of the kind of depth of coverage. I mean, I imagine that MSNBC built its viewership in Wisconsin during that time because they spent so much time, Ed Schultz coming down and broadcasting from here and so on. And it's very weird to see somebody like Rachel Maddow, who was not here, was not from here, didn't particularly know Wisconsin, talking about something that I had just experienced that day or that week in ways that were more insightful and better on target than the local media. But the other thing about it is it was just sort of at this, most of the young people already had smartphones, or at least phones that were smart enough that they could text easily. Everybody involved was using or quickly came to use stuff like Facebook. So I know I heard people talk about this with the spring uprisings in the Middle East, look, we've got this Twitter revolution, but you know, this is really kind of the social media role in politics. That's really Wisconsin. We were seeing that already in Wisconsin, and there's a lot of truth to it. I mean, the people who are really doing a lot of the work organizationally were very plugged in, but we were still sort of on the cusp of it. I mean, I was not using Twitter at that point. I didn't have a smartphone where I could text or, you know, or follow Twitter feeds or something like that at that point. So it was really, in retrospect, it was a serious break in some ways in terms of media coverage. I mean, Cap Times doing good work. Some of the national media were pretty much on top of things, but seeing it's a trend that's been going on for well over a century in this country, that local journalism has been pressed harder and harder. And, you know, you see the loss of the Cap Times, where the city actually had two different newspapers, daily newspapers. And you go to the state journal's offices a couple of years ago and just see just how many cubicles are empty, how many desks are empty, you know. And so I'm not saying that the state journal was intentionally doing bad coverage, but they simply didn't have the resources in part. I think the editorial, they were on the wrong side, not just from my political point of view, but in terms of what was right for the community and the state. But I think they didn't have the resources at that point to do it. And the timing of the protests make it really interesting, because you really don't have social media. I mean, if the same thing happened right now, you know exactly, everybody knows exactly what they would do, who they would follow on Twitter, and mm-hmm. those people that don't use Twitter would start using it. The Facebook groups would be up within 35 seconds and so forth. It wasn't quite to that point yet. I mean, you could see things happening, but it wasn't there. So it's kind of a transition point in how I thought about the media's role in state politics.
So for you personally, getting specific information about what was going on, it sounds like it came in two ways. Either you got an email or someone sent you a text, or maybe a cell phone call, but it was either cell phone, but not the social media now aspects of what a smartphone can do.
Yeah, and then, for sure.
And then your laptop using email.
Yeah. And an amazing amount just by face-to-face. And that was in some ways, the value of being down there so much, that you were talking to people all the time. And not the kind of, you would expect, given how chaotic things were, you might expect it all to be a giant game of telephone, where everything you hear is just some bizarre, whimsical rock lyric version of some serious message that was there 20 people ago. And actually, people were taking care. Information was being. In retrospect, I'm pretty impressed at how good the information flow was, and it flowed in all sorts of weird ways. One night. I know this is one way I can't connect it to any to a date in any way. I bike even in the winter, and so what I would do is I'd finish whatever my last set obligation was on campus, and I would just bike down to the Capitol and bike home from there. Snow tires, so you know, because it was winter.
Mm-hmm.
One night I came out, and there was a piece of notebook paper wrapped around the handlebars and cables of my bicycle. And so, and you know, people were leafleting, like anything that was there was going to have a leaflet stuck on it sometimes. But this was literally torn out of a loose leaf out of a binder notebook and folded up. And it was from a set of graduate students who had recognized my bicycle as they were walking home from school to the east side. And it just said, I've got it somewhere. It's not in this office. No, it's think of that at my Van Nuys office. And it just says, thank you, Joe. And it was signed by the graduate students. So that wasn't a meaningful, it was an extremely meaningful communication, but it wasn't a substantive piece of political stuff. But that's how random the purpose of that story is. That's how random it could get. And the TA office always had, you know, there were notes up for everybody and people and unexpected people, and so yeah, but it was definitely pre-social media from my point of view.
Mm-hmm. Joe, I want to wrap it up here. We're just about at an hour.
Okay.
We have at least one more, so we'll schedule that after we turn this off. So thank you very much for your time, Joe.
Sure.
Appreciate it.